All of us know what it feels like to be depressed about something, but major depressive disorder or clinical depression is something else entirely. This hour, we'll learn about clinical depression and promising new treatments. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Clinical depression is a very common disorder. Approximately 6.7% of adults struggle with it each year. Today, we'll talk about new developments in the study and treatment of depression with Dr. Jimmy Potash, professor and chair of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. I'll also talk with Daniel Finney, the Metro columnist for the Des Moines Register. He's been writing about his weight loss journey and his struggle with depression. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Everyone feels blue from time to time, but clinical depression is a disorder that interferes with daily life. It's also a very common disease that has far-reaching consequences for most of the people who struggle with it. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that 6.7% of adults in the United States experience major depressive disorder every year. In this hour, we'll talk about depression, and we'll get an update on new approaches and treatments for those who struggle with it. My first guest today is Daniel Finney. He's the Metro columnist for the Des Moines Register, and since last April, he's been sharing his weight loss journey and struggles with depression and anxiety with readers through his blog, Making Weight. He's been trying a treatment that is new to him, transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS treatments, to deal with his depression, and he is with me now. Hello, Daniel.
Greetings.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
How long, and I realize a lot of people struggle with depression for a long time before ever being diagnosed, but from what you can remember, how long do you feel you've dealt with clinical depression?
I started to deal with depression in college. I don't know that I called it depression at the time. I don't even know that I was asking for a diagnosis. I think I started seeing the campus mental health system and was just doing talk therapy at the time. I wasn't approaching it as a medical problem. I was approaching it as I had some things go badly in my life. I had some traumas, and I was trying to unravel those. And I believed that if I eventually talked enough about these problems, that I would figure everything out, and then I would feel fine. I didn't address the medical part of depression, the chemistry in the brain, levels of certain chemicals that are too low or too high. I didn't really start to do that until 2001.
And you have written in your blog about the fact that you take a number of different medications to help you cope with this. Over the years, have there been treatments that you really felt helped?
Yes. I mean, there were medicines that I stayed on for a long time without incident. And there would be times when the medications would fail, which is fairly commonplace. You can build up immunities. Stresses in your life can change your brain chemistry. You know, I lost a job. That was very stressful. And the stresses of that increased my anxiety symptoms and so forth. So there certainly was. There were many stable periods where the symptoms were livable or not prevalent to the point that they were stymieing being able to work or interact with people in the way that I would normally choose to do so.
What made you think that trying transcranial magnetic stimulation would be a good idea? What drew you to this treatment?
Well, I had a major depressive episode, and there are many tiers to depression. And I think that when you talk about depression, most people think, oh, you're just feeling a little down, you know, get a little bit of exercise, go out in the sun, hang out with some friends, you know, and you'll cheer up. That's not really depression. Depression is a kind of a feeling of hopelessness, a mental inertia, so to speak, where you just can't do anything and you lose interest in the activities that used to bring you pleasure. You know, if you're a sports fan, you don't care about the game. If you like to read, you can't concentrate long enough to read a book, or you sort of fog out. And there are other ways of that. Depression manifests itself that I haven't experienced. But a major depressive disorder is sort of like the bottom falls out of the elevator and you fall and you don't think you're ever going to reach the bottom. And you have a sort of a black outlook on everything. You get into what I call looping, in which you get into thought patterns. That one problem, it could, no matter how insignificant or small, becomes ultimately ends in death or, you know, just horrible circumstances. It's just a series of bad thinking patterns that continue to spiral. And I was in the middle of one of these episodes, and it had gone on for weeks, close to a month. And I had been seeing my talk therapist, and I had been seeing my psychiatrist. And my psychiatrist does transcranial magnetic stimulation, and he explained the process to me. And I was a little dicey about it, because there aren't long longitudinal studies on the science of it. It's relatively new. It was first approved by the FDA in 2008. The type of treatment that I'm using was approved in 2013. So it's very new, and I was kind of afraid it was hokum. If not hokum, you know, would be the kind of thing that would have minimal effects, you know, or it wouldn't hurt, but it wouldn't help, and, you know, it would just be sort of an expense to insurance and myself.
And
but
what's the idea behind it? What is it supposed to do?
Well, the way that I understand it is that the device that they put on my head sends a magnetic pulses in short bursts to the area of the brain where depression lives. And it is stimulating, the pulses are stimulating nerve endings that allow them to be more susceptible to the chemistry of the brain, the serotonins, endorphins, and whatnot that make your thinking, make your brain function without the deep depression.
So you started this treatment how long ago?
I started October the 7th.
And how often do you receive the treatment?
5 days a week in an acute phase. And my last few treatments are this week. And then there is a maintenance phase where there's one or two treatments a week for 3 or 4 weeks. And that'll start soon.
And what is your impression of it so far? How do you feel it's worked?
Well, you take various psychological surveys after so many treatments. So you take one survey at five treatments, and you take that survey and another survey at 10 treatments. And the survey asks you a series of pointed questions about how you're feeling. And it's like golf. The lower the score, the better. So when I started back in the beginning of October, on one of the measures, I scored a 22. The highest that you can score is a 26 on the survey, which means, you know, very, very depressed. The last time that I took it, which was earlier this week, my score was 1.
Wow.
Now, granted, that's self-reporting, but there's no benefit to me to lie about it. So if I didn't feel good and I was placebo affecting, so to speak, and, oh, well, I paid a lot of money for this, I better mark it lower. I didn't do that. I marked how I felt. And when I filled out the surveys, I was surprised myself. I thought, I haven't thought that way in a long time. So you rate yourself on a 1 through 3 scale or 0. And I was surprised on the number of times that I was marking a 0. It was hard for me to recognize the change initially. I'd say that I started to feel better within 2.5 weeks of treatment. But other people noticed. My grandmother said, well, you really seem like your old self. My parents said I seemed to be more animated. Friends said I was more centered, seemingly more confident, talkative. I don't know that I really noticed it myself until later process, but now I feel fairly strong. I feel on the verge of, if not, I would never use the word cured because that's not how the disease works, the disorder works, I should say, but I feel on the verge of remission.
Wow. How do you feel about the tapering process, knowing that this has really helped you and that you're feeling good right now? Is it frightening to think about stopping the treatments or at least doing it less often?
It is somewhat. I will be more anxious when my doctor and I discuss tapering medication. You know, I'll want to see some consistency and continuity in my feeling and, avoiding that inertia, that terrible sense of being frozen and lost. I want to see that, the absence of that in my daily routine sustained after, we take the helmet off. The last time before I start to do that. So there is some anxiety involved in that. I'll be glad to finish the process and keep moving forward.
Daniel Finney, thank you so much.
And thanks for having me.
Daniel Finney is the Metro columnist for the Des Moines Register. Since last April, he's been sharing his weight loss journey and his struggles with depression and anxiety with readers on the blog Making Weight. Recently, he's been using transcranial magnetic stimulation treatments to work on his depression. We'll continue our conversation about depression and new treatments for depression in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about major depressive disorder or clinical depression, new developments in the study of depression, and some promising new treatments. With me now is Dr. Jimmy Potash. He's professor and chair of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Potash, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Charity. Great to be with you.
Now, we just listened to Daniel Finney describe his own personal struggles with depression, his own journey through depression. And I realize that everyone who struggles with depression struggles with it in a very different way. Can you start us off with sort of a definition of clinical depression or major depressive disorder?
Sure. I have to say, I think Daniel did a really wonderful job of describing quite vividly what depression is like. It's you can see that he must be you can see that he's a writer. He has great powers of description. But it's true that depressions really they vary from one person to another. I guess first of all, what depression is not, and Daniel said this, is it's not simply feeling sad. You know, people in when we think about what people commonly mean when they talk about depression in sort of ordinary language, they think about having a reaction to something that didn't go well and feeling badly about it. But in psychiatry, when we think about depression, we're thinking about something that's much more complex and troubling. And it sometimes involves feeling sad, but just as often, it's not sadness that a person feels emotionally. It's emptiness, the absence of feeling. And there's a kind of bleakness and hopelessness that goes along with feeling very little or nothing. At the same time, people often are not thinking very clearly when they're depressed. They may feel a little confused. They may not remember things very well. They may be quite irrational in some ways. And then in addition, their physical aspects to depression. Often people's sleep is disrupted. Often their eating pattern changes quite dramatically, and their energy level is often very much decreased. So all of those things together constitute what we sometimes refer to as clinical depression or major depression.
We're going to talk about some promising new treatments for depression, but do you feel, as a psychiatrist, do you feel that we are still learning new things about what depression is and what it does to our brains?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we in psychiatry, we've been trying to understand depression for a very, very long time, and we've learned some things, thank goodness. We do have some ideas about what's happening in the brain in depression. But really, as with all of psychiatry, you know, in a lot of aspects of medical illness, we've pinned down what exactly is going wrong, what exactly it is that's sort of broken in the body when you have a particular illness. You know, 100 years ago, we learned that when you have pneumonia, there's a particular kind of bacteria or several different types of bacteria that cause very particular changes in the lungs, and that's why people get pneumonia. In psychiatry, we're still not sure exactly how things go wrong in the brain, and that's very much true for depression. We know about, for example, serotonin, which plays a role in depression, and we know that too little of it has something to do with depression. But there's a lot still to learn.
Are there things recently that we have discovered that you feel give us some hope for treatment? And we'll talk about what some of the common treatments are and what some of the new treatments are. But are there things we're learning that help us treat depression?
Yeah, so I mentioned serotonin, and serotonin and norepinephrine are two chemicals in the brain that are called neurotransmitters. And for 50 years or so, we've known that they have something to do with depression and that they have something to do with how antidepressant medicines work. In recent years, we've begun to get some clues about other kinds of mechanisms that might be at work. And one of them has to do with the idea that the growth of new brain cells in a part of the brain that's called the hippocampus, buried deep in the brain, the growth of new brain cells there might have something to do with depression. That is, in particular, the absence or reduction in normal growth there might have something to do with depression. And conversely, the idea that stimulating that growth might play a role in treating depression. That's one example.
We've been treating depression for quite some time, and there was a lot of growth in the chemical treatment of depression, particularly in the 1970s and the 1980s. Prozac came about in the late 1980s, which is a drug, the brand name for a drug that many people are familiar with. And then there seemed to sort of be an explosion of all of these related drugs.
Yeah.
So the SSRIs, that's one of them, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the MAOIs, and that one's escaping me
right now.
You can tell me.
And the tricyclic antidepressants.
Okay. Right. And so there are all of these related drugs that work in similar ways. Over time, how have the drugs changed?
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. There are a lot of antidepressant drugs available. There are about 25 antidepressant drugs on the market, which is a pretty good number. The problem, and they work pretty well. That is, they get maybe 70% of people better, which is not bad, not nearly as good as we would like. Part of the problem is that those drugs are all seem to operate in fairly similar ways. That is, we think that all of them mostly operate through influencing those two neurotransmitters I mentioned earlier, serotonin and norepinephrine. What we have not had, unfortunately, until very recently, are treatments that seem to work through entirely different avenues, entirely different mechanisms. And that's, you know, part of the reason we're so excited about some of these new treatments like transcranial magnetic stimulation is that they seem to be doing something very different than these old drugs.
Well, and how effective do the drugs seem to be for people who are suffering from depression?
Well, you know, if you take any given drug like Prozac and you give it to 100 people who have depression, you're going to get about 60% of them better. Now, you know, that's a whole lot better than nothing, but it's not nearly as good as we would ideally like. If you then try another drug and another, if you try a second and a third and a fourth choice, you'll get 10 to 15% more people better. So that leaves a big chunk of people, you know, it's 20 to 30% not doing so well with our medicines. And then our current medicines do have side effects that can be quite troubling.
Do you think that the prevalence of these medicines has led us to treat milder forms of depression as well?
Well, so the big breakthrough with Prozac, which came out in the late 1980s, was that it had a whole lot fewer side effects than the older antidepressants that people were using in the 1960s and 70s and into the early 80s. Prozac was much, much safer. And because it was much safer and had fewer side effects, lots of doctors, typically not psychiatrists, people like internal medicine doctors and family medicine doctors, felt that they could prescribe it without having to worry. And so the prescription, the use of it did become much broader than antidepressants had been before.
Let's talk about some of the new treatments since we were talking with Daniel Finney about TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, a few minutes ago. Tell me how or what the idea behind that is, how it's supposed to work.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, first of all, that to give you a little bit of background, the way the brain works is based on sort of two different kinds of communication. So the brain has chemical communication from one brain cell to another, and then it has electrical communication across the brain. So it's this complex interplay of chemical communication, electrical communication, back and forth. We try to change the chemistry by using the medicines that we've been talking about, Prozac and many other antidepressants. But there have also been attempts to change the electrical signaling as a way of treating illness. And the big way that we've done that over the years is through ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. So electroconvulsive therapy is actually the oldest modern treatment in psychiatry. It was invented in 1938 in Italy, and it spread around the world very, very quickly. It was being used here at Iowa as early as the early 1940s. And in fact, it was a researcher, a psychiatrist and researcher here in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Iowa, who was the first person in the world to demonstrate that if you gave ECT to people with depression, it took away their suicidal thoughts. So it's been used a long time, and it's very effective and pretty safe as well. But TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, is in some ways a relative of ECT in that it's trying to do something similar. It's trying to change the electrical patterns in the brain as a way of treating depression.
But in a much less dramatic way, it seems.
That's right. That's right. It's much less what we call invasive, meaning with ECT, you have to bring someone in. ECT is sort of like getting minor surgery. You come into a surgical, a place that's sort of like a place where you do minor surgery. You have an anesthesiologist, the person gets put to sleep. And so it's kind of it's a big deal to administer it.
Right, you have to have someone to drive you and
yes,
and support you.
Exactly. TMS is much more low-key in that you're wide awake. You don't have to be put to sleep. You sort of lie back and something gets put on the side of your head, almost like holding a blow dryer to a person's head. And you get this magnetic wave that's sent into your brain. And you don't even necessarily know anything's happening. You don't necessarily feel anything, although sometimes people feel a little bit of twitching in their scalp. And the magnetic wave goes into the brain, and if you remember your high school physics, there's a relationship between magnetism and electricity. The magnetic wave changes the electrical pattern in the brain.
And so it changes it during treatment, and we were talking with Daniel Finney about it earlier.
Yeah.
So he is going daily to have this treatment for a while, and then it will taper off. But by changing it during treatment, what is the lasting effect of that?
Well, the good news is we know that there is a lasting effect. But like with a lot of our treatments in medicine, we don't know quite how that happens. It's true for a lot of things we do in psychiatry. It's also true for a lot of things that happen throughout medicine. There are treatments we give that we can see work, but we don't necessarily know precisely how the physiology is changing in the brain to cause that lasting outcome.
What are studies showing as far as the efficacy of TMS? How is it working?
Well, it's been around about 20 years, and it's been studied a lot. And studies generally show that people who get TMS do better than people who get what's called sham treatment. That is, when you study this,
a placebo treatment.
Yeah, exactly. Sham treatment is placebo treatment. You sort of act as if you're giving the treatment, but in fact, there's no magnetic wave going in there. And so we know that people who get real treatment do better than people who get placebo. That's the good news. The maybe slightly less good news is that the treatment, the response rate is not terribly high. It's around 30%, about 30% of people, in the best studies say that about 30% of people who get the treatment do well. Now, important caveat to that. In a sense, that's an underestimate of how well it works, probably, because the people who've been enrolled in these studies have mostly been people who've failed other treatments.
Hmm. These are people with depression that's very difficult to treat.
Exactly. Exactly. And so if you pick a bunch of people who've got difficult to treat depression, well, it sort of makes sense that maybe their response rate would be lower than would be the case if you just picked 100 random people with depression.
Well, and part of the cycle of depression with treating depression, with the drugs that are prescribed, someone will benefit, time will go on, and they will either need to increase their dosage or try another drug as their body gets used to that. With electromagnetic stimulation, transcranial magnetic stimulation, mm-hmm. Is this a treatment that has to be redone as someone cycles through another period of depression?
Probably. You're right. That's how it works with ECT, electroconvulsive treatment. Electroconvulsive treatment gets people better roughly 75% of the time, which is quite good.
All right. And then things get bad again, they go through the treatment again.
They'd have to go back and, right, exactly. If for people who get ECT, typically they get well. They get very well, but they don't necessarily stay well for the long haul. And if they get ill again, they might well come back for another round of treatment.
And with TMS, is it too early to know what the cycle is like?
It is. There has not been a lot of study of just how often people fall back into depression after TMS, but it seems quite likely that the pattern would be the same. That is, although it gets you well, it doesn't guarantee you stay well. What typically would happen would be after the TMS, you'd go on antidepressant medication with the idea that if you're on the best medication, you're going to have a better chance of staying well.
Right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This hour, we're talking about depression and some promising new treatments for major depressive disorder. With me is Dr. Jimmy Potash. He is a professor and chair of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk about new research about the drug ketamine and how that may be used to treat people with depression. We also want to hear from you with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about clinical depression, major depressive disorder. We're talking about new research about how it works and also about promising new treatments this hour. You're welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me is Dr. Jimmy Potash. He's professor and chair of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Now, ketamine is another drug that seems to be very promising in the treatment of depression, and it's been getting a lot of press because ketamine is considered to be a recreational drug by some people, a club drug. Tell me what we know about how ketamine works with people with depression.
Well, yes, there is a lot of excitement about ketamine for a couple of reasons. One, I was saying before that there's been so little development of drugs that are truly new in the way they work for depression, but the other big issue is there. As you said at the beginning of the hour, depression is a very, very common illness. I think you quoted the number 6.7% of Americans are depressed this year, and if you look at the lifetime risk, it's about 15% of all Americans will have a depressive episode at some point in their lives.
Well, and I think that's probably a low number because a lot of people never seek treatment for it as well, right?
Yeah, so it's very, very common. And a big chunk, although our main treatments are pretty good, there's still a big chunk of people who just don't get well. They don't respond to the treatments that we have, which means there are a lot of people out there who are pretty desperate because, as Daniel described so vividly, depression can just be incredibly miserable thing to experience, and when people are feeling that way for a long time, they're desperate to find something that'll make a difference. And so ketamine came along about 15 years ago, was first described as having the ability to get people out of depression quickly. So that was one of the things that was so new and different. The current medicines that we use take at least a week before they work, and sometimes 2 weeks or longer. Ketamine seemed to make a difference within hours or a day. It got people better very, very quickly. And so there was a tremendous amount of excitement about that, and there continues to be. It does seem to make a real difference for a good chunk of people.
Now, a lot of this is something that, you know, the articles pop up, or the radio reports, the television reports pop up about ketamine. And as you mentioned, I mean, the talk started about 15 years ago. So as people have actually done research on ketamine and what it does with people, what do we know about, I mean, you know that it sort of people respond to it instantly, but do we know what it's doing to the brain?
Well, there has been a lot of work since that report 15 years ago. There's been a lot of work by psychiatrists testing the drug, and there's also been a lot of work by neuroscientists trying to understand exactly what it is doing in the brain. And we have some clues. The biggest clue, what we think is likely going on, is that ketamine is impacting a different chemical in the brain than the other antidepressants. Again, we talked about serotonin and norepinephrine, which is where most of the attention has been. Those are two neurotransmitters, chemicals that communicate from one brain cell to another. That's where the focus has been for many, many years. But ketamine seems to be impacting a neurotransmitter called glutamate. And glutamate is referred to as the major excitatory neurotransmitter, meaning it's the neurotransmitter that seems to say through which one neuron tells another to get fired up. And the ketamine seems to block the receptor for glutamate on brain cells. So that much we know. And there's a lot of work being done right now to try to pinpoint more precisely how that relates to depression.
Is it a treatment? I know that a lot of people have been doing research on it. Is it a treatment that's actually being used in practice?
It is considered experimental. It's not FDA approved for this use, for use in depression. It's an FDA approved drug. It's been used as a drug by anesthesiologists for a long time. So it's an FDA approved drug. It's not FDA approved for use in depression. But the way the regulatory process works is if a drug is FDA approved for anything, it can be used for so-called off-label purposes by anyone who wants to use it that way, meaning people are free to use it for depression if they want. And in fact, there are a number of practices that have sprung up around the country that are advertising themselves as places to come to get ketamine treatment for depression.
But this isn't something that necessarily people's insurance would cover, which creates
That's right.
An issue in seeking this treatment, certainly.
That's right.
Also, what do we know about side effects?
Well, there are side effects, and as I think you said earlier, ketamine is a drug that's been abused in the past and in the present. You know, it is a drug that some people abuse because it does create psychedelic kind of effects in higher doses. And so I say in higher doses the doses that people use when they abuse it are something like three times as high as the dose that's used to treat depression.
Hmm.
But even at the dose used to treat depression, some people have strange feelings. Sometimes people see psychedelic colors or psychedelic kind of light effects. Sometimes they have an out-of-body kind of feeling, like they're floating outside of themselves. So that can happen.
There is further research going on, even at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. There's a doctor there that's testing a different way to give ketamine. Tell me about that.
That's right. That's right. The way that ketamine has been used for the most part since 2000 is intravenously. You have to get hooked up to an IV, and of course that's a very cumbersome kind of way to have a drug delivered. Several of the companies that are trying to develop new versions of ketamine for broad use in depression are thinking that if you can use it intranasally, meaning essentially putting it up your nose like nose drops, that would be far easier. And so there's a study that we're a part of here. Bill Coryell, who's a national leader in in the field of depression, and who's part of our department here at Iowa, is part of a study going on in several places around the country and the world that's testing this intranasal use of ketamine to treat depression.
For people who have been struggling with depression for a very long time and maybe get some benefits from the medications that are pretty common but never quite shake it off, and they hear about these other treatments and they get frustrated because, you know, it can be in the testing phase for decades. What is your advice to people if they think, I really need to try something else, but I don't have access to it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's easy to imagine how frustrating it would be to be in that position. As I was saying earlier, I know how wrenching it can be to be in the midst of depression, and I know how eager people are when they're feeling that way to find something that's going to provide relief. The flip side is that when you go too quickly to a new treatment, you can never be sure that there aren't important and side effects that are very, very problematic. So, of course, we get excited about the potential upside of a new treatment, but there's always concern about potential downsides. And with ketamine, there is some evidence in animals that ketamine can kill brain cells. So, of course, that's worrisome.
Right.
Now, we think that only occurs at very high doses, much, much, much higher than we would use to treat depression. So we don't think that's a problem. But that's the kind of thing that makes you feel like, gosh, we really want to get as much evidence as we can and be really sure before we start giving this out to thousands and maybe even millions eventually of people. I do think that people in Iowa who are interested in using ketamine can certainly contact Dr. Coriel and inquire about whether they might be able to be a part of the studies that he has ongoing.
So that could give hope to some people. I want to read this email from Anne. She said, I distinctly remember sitting at my little desk in the fifth grade and having a wave of hopelessness come over me. I also remember the thought, what's the use of it all? I lived that way until finally getting the right medication and therapy in my 30s. My advice, you don't have to live this way, but you have to be completely honest with someone about how bad it really is. Well-meaning people will not understand the depths that a person can go to and how the right medications can sometimes change a hopeless life to one worth living. It will never get perfect, so don't expect it, but I can walk down the street now and feel like I'm part of the human race and not separate from it. I think that really helps us understand people who don't suffer from depression do have a very difficult time empathizing with people who do.
Yeah, that is really very beautifully put. I think that's absolutely right. I think what a common misconception is that when people are depressed, a common misconception is that what they're experiencing is the same kind of sadness that we all feel. And a common misconception, as Daniel pointed out earlier, is that, well, you're feeling sad, and why don't you just go for a run and you'll feel better? You know, the idea is that there's something easy you can do to turn it around. And I think most people who haven't experienced depression or been very up close and personal with it don't understand that it's such a fundamentally different state of being. And in fact, it's a disease process at work in the brain that often is not amenable to any very quick or easy fix. Although, as your writer points out, the good news is it can be treated. You know, most of the time we do awfully well treating it. Most of the time, a combination of medications and talk therapy or psychotherapy makes a huge difference for people.
Let's go to the phones. Mark is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
Hi there. And you recently have gone through the tapering process to get off Prozac, and you want to talk about that. What was your experience like?
I was surprised how difficult it was. I started taking Prozac because I suffer from seasonal affective disorder, and I was also in a very stressful job at the time. And I've learned to treat my seasonal affective disorder with a light treatment now, and I've retired, so I'm no longer in that stressful job. So I thought, well, I'll see if I can't wean myself off of Prozac. And it was very, very difficult, and I've had a number of times where I was having suicidal thoughts. I was under-motivated. I thought, if I had realized how hard this was going to be to get off, I might not have gotten on in the first place. I was on the lowest possible dosage.
Dr. Potash, can you respond to that?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly not everybody does well on medication. I do think that, I don't know if everybody's familiar with seasonal affective disorder, which goes by the clever acronym SAD, but that is a very real thing. That is, there's a subset of people with depression whose mood really does very distinctly decline right about this time of year, when the days have gotten much, much shorter and darker. And bright light therapy, where a person sits in front of a very, very bright light that simulates natural sunlight, something like 30 more minutes every morning, has been studied and shown to help a good proportion of those people.
So in avoiding possibly taking medication, I think it's probably surprising to people who are not familiar with this treatment that it's difficult to get off of this medication. It is something that you have to manage. You don't just quit taking one of these drugs, right?
That's right. So for a lot of our medications, people do better if they get off of them slowly rather than all at once.
For those of us who live with and love people who suffer from depression, clinical depression, do you have any advice for us? Because this cycle can be so frustrating for those who are trying to help.
Yeah, for people who are trying to help, I think the more you learn about depression, the better. Because there are a lot of subtleties and a lot of complexities, and I think what people who learn a lot about depression come to realize after a while is they come to learn when they should push a person and when pushing really isn't going to make any difference at all. That is to say, when a person is very severely depressed, the only useful thing you can do is just try to be as supportive as you can. There's no pushing that's going to make any difference at all. It's sort of like trying to push someone who's just broken their leg to sprint down the street. This can't happen. But when a person's depression is in a much milder state, sometimes a little bit of pushing can be useful at that point. So there's a whole toolkit that ideally a support person would have, and certainly lots and lots of support, sometimes some pushiness or tough love, and certainly the being prepared to have a plan when there's an emergency is another really useful thing.
Would you suggest that people who are in the family of someone who struggles with depression, can they talk to the provider who works with your loved one?
Oh, great, great, great point. I think that's incredibly important. Yeah, I think that providers should involve family as much as possible, and families should push to be involved as much as possible. I think we underuse that in our field, that we underuse the power of loving and motivated family members.
Dr. Jimmy Potash, thank you so much for being here today.
It was really a pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Jimmy Potash is a professor and chair of psychiatry at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We've been talking about depression and promising new treatments this hour. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.